Well, shall we get started, Sam?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Well, welcome, listeners, to episode 20 of Know Your Enemy. I'm Matt Sittman, one of the podcast co-hosts, and I'm here with my friend, Sam Adler-Bell.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
I'm not doing too bad.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, all things considered.
Yeah, you can't ever just say everything's fine and move on to the next part of the conversation. You always have to be like, well, you know, considering, gestures wildly at everything. Right. So episode 20, this is. We've got 20 episodes.
It's hard to believe.
I would say that we're back from a little bit of a not pre-arranged break, but some life things intervened. And so there was a little delay between this episode and our last one in front of the paywall. But we're coming back.
In style.
In a style, with a vengeance, with this episode, which is about what?
Well, we finally are doing a deep dive into the Never Trump figures who I'm sure many of our listeners will be familiar with.
That's right. And we've got really the perfect guest for this episode fell into our laps this week. We're having Samuel Moyne on. Professor Moyne is the Henry R. Luce Professor of Jurisprudence at Yale Law School and a professor of history at Yale University. His most recent book is called Not Enough, Human Rights in an Unequal World, which came out in 2018. He's also a fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. That actually comes up in our conversation. It's a sort of left-right alliance of thinkers and writers who are cautioning foreign policy restraint. And he's written a bunch of books about European intellectual history and human rights history. And he writes for a bunch of different outlets, The Times, Boston Review, Chronicle of Higher Ed, London Review of Books, Dissent, and most recently, The New Republic, which is what occasioned this episode.
Yes, Sam reviewed a new book about, or a recent book, I should say, it came out, I think, in May, about the Never Trumpers, written by two political scientists, Robert Soudan and Stephen Tellis. And yeah, his piece in the New Republic was kind of jumping off of this book. And when we read it, we just really wanted to talk to him about it because, well, you know, at one level, it's easy to, especially if you're on the left, kind of dunk on the Never Trumpers.
Yeah.
You know, look at the Twitter feeds of Bill Kristol or, you know, George Conway or Steve Schmidt or some of these people. And, but we tried to go a little deeper. And yeah, Sam was the perfect guest for that. It really goes into some interesting places, I thought.
It does. And we don't have to give it all away, only to say that this is a, we're going to do a bit of the intellectual kind of history of this group of figures and situate them in sort of American politics from before Trump to now. I think that people are going to get a lot out of it.
I got a lot out of it.
Me too.
By the way, Sam, I wanted to say one place that Sam Moyne has published you didn't mention is Commonweal, my publication.
It's actually on this list that he sent me. It's the third one on this list.
Oh, did you say it and I didn't hear it?
No, I just didn't read them all. Yeah. There's a million.
Yeah. But no, I think Sam's really one of our brilliant public intellectuals and someone who uses his academic expertise to intervene in debates going on now in a really clear and helpful way.
Yeah.
So he's just someone I admire a lot, and I was really honored and glad he came on the show. Well, before we turn to the conversation, once again, we're so grateful Dissent sponsors this podcast. And for those of you who want to support us on Patreon, please consider doing so. But if you subscribe for $10 a month or more, you get a free digital subscription to Dissent.
That's right. And for $5 a month, you get access to all of our bonus episodes, which are very good, including our last one, which was a deep dive on depression and politics. So please do sign up if you want to hear that dispatch from the sad left.
Yeah. Well, anything else, Sam? Any other housekeeping?
I don't think so. Yeah, I think we should get to our episode with Samuel Moyne with no further ado. Two Sams on this episode.
I know.
Hope it doesn't confuse anybody.
I don't think it will, but they're both good Sams.
Thank you for saying that. I don't have both a PhD and a law degree or teach at Yale yet.
Right. There's still time.
definitely gonna cut that. All right. Enjoy this interview with Samuel Moyne. Hi, Sam Moyne. Welcome to Know Your Enemy.
Thanks for having me. Longtime fan.
Are we being too familiar by calling you Sam?
No, that's what everyone calls me.
Okay, me too. My dad every once in a while calls me Samuel, but almost no one else.
I do use Samuel like in print, you know, and on book covers and things, but almost no one calls me Samuel. My wife calls me Sammy sometimes.
That's cute. All right, so what are we talking about, Matt?
Well, even though the title Know Your Enemy is a bit tongue-in-cheek, the enemies we focused on have mainly been the new conservative nationalists, the illiberal right. We've talked a lot about Trump, but we want to talk about a different sort of enemy, perhaps, if we can use that term, which is the Never Trumpers.
Sounds good. I mean, you might have to retitle this episode Know Your Frenemy in the sense that, you know, my worry is that people are treating them too friendly, you know, too much as friends and not enough as enemies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think we're with you on that. I mean, I find them personally just extremely annoying, but we can get into why that's the case. But maybe to begin with, like, who are the Never Trumpers? You name some of them in this piece. Listeners will be familiar, I'm sure, with, you know, people like Bill Kristol or Rick Wilson or George Conway. But who are this kind of amorphous cast of characters called Never Trumpers?
Well, it's a pretty big group. And one of the reasons to read the book I reviewed, which is entitled Never Trump, The Revolt of the Conservative Elites by Stephen Tellis and Robert Salden, is just that it gives you the dramatis personae, and they kind of disaggregate the group into various subgroups. I dwell on maybe most with the national security experts, which would include someone like William Kristol, a neocon. But kind of when you descend through the ranks, you get lots of other people who don't answer to that description, and may just be kind of national security specialists who mobilized in 2016. And part of the debate is, you know, why were they upset in 2016? And then we turn to some other groups like, you know, those that Salden and Tellis call public intellectuals, which could include people like Jonah Goldberg, Kevin Williamson. Your first guest, Ross Douthat, is a kind of Never Trump. I think he's actually a soft Never Trumper, with a kind of hidden agenda, if you like, very different from some of these other intellectuals. But those are folks who are scribes, scribblers, writing, and then they have a section on economists and lawyers and so forth. So it's a very large group of people who kind of formed a kind of elective community of Republicans or conservatives who thought that Trump was beyond the pale at some point or other.
Yeah. There's been a sort of shorthand that some people have used to describe both who they are and why it was a more obvious choice for them to object to Trump, which is that they're mostly neocons. If you treat them all as neocons and that's their motivation, then you can see why, from the standpoint of the trade policies that Trump was supporting, from the standpoint of the more isolationist foreign policy, especially in rhetoric, then it all makes sense. But given that they're not all neocons, what were the different motivations that these people had for opposing Trump when most Republicans didn't?
So, like the larger conservative movement of the past decades you've been exploring, this group is also a group of strange bedfellows.
Yeah.
And it's true that the neocons, which include some of the most prominent folks in this Never Trump movement, were kind of principally interested in foreign policy, although we can get into whether they were right to be so outraged, especially when it comes to, say, you know, Israel policy or really foreign policy in general, trade policy. But, you know, as you have explored, the conservative movement also included in its fusionist guise some kind of libertarian types, economic libertarians, some that we would call neoliberals, who have an international foreign policy around trade, but also are very suspicious of the American state and redistributive politics at home. And, you know, they also had a lot of, you know, worry about Trump, especially the kinds that join this Niskanen Center, who are kind of leftish libertarians of, you know, and then there were, you know, constitutional scholars who, even though Trump is like one of the best things for their project in getting so many conservatives on the bench were very skeptical and drew a line because they felt Trump was somehow troubling. And I think each of these subcommunities has different priors and responding in different ways.
Yeah, that sounds right. Do you want to explain sort of more of the thesis of your piece? Because one of the things that I thought was helpful about it was that instead of really trying to disentangle all the different motivations, the like personal, you know, stories of valor and principle that these people sort of self-narrate about why they opposed Trump when so many of their former comrades didn't, your piece sort of gets into, well, what is the project in its effect, sort of instrumentally? And I'd be interested to just sort of hear you draw that out.
Sure. So I think the piece has two stages. I mean, the book, it's a book review. The book is really just about 2016 and the dynamics of the makings of the Never Trump movement. And I basically skeptical of the method and outcomes of why these authors think Never Trump came about. They say these are principled conservatives. And in fact, democracy depends on principled conservatives, because we know from, you know, Weimar Germany that when conservatives decide to put Adolf Hitler in power, the whole regime goes. And so we should really kind of, you know, empathize and hope for the best for principled conservatives when they draw the line, when despots are in the making. I don't think that's a plausible account, probably in general, which we can get into, but of 2016, for a couple reasons. One is just narrowly about the kind of national security side. I think the big event that drove the Never Trump coalition was Donald Trump's shattering of the taboo amongst conservatives around criticizing the Iraq war, which was, I think we forget, a huge event. But like maybe more generally, I think my basic take is that these are folks on the make. They're not only principled or maybe principled at all. They're interested in exercising power, and they've done that within the Republican Party, and they lost control in 2016. And both then and later, most of their actions are best accounted for, like, realistically. They're angling for advantage and influence, and my trouble, we get to the second stage of my argument, is that they've actually exercised tons of influence.
Yeah, well, let's take that thesis of yours that they're on the make. What was kind of the bet that they made? Because the Never Trump movement, hashtag Never Trump, emerged during the primaries. So it was kind of the first bet that Trump would actually lose. And by standing up to him relatively early, they might, you know, be on the right side of that. But then Trump got the nomination and then actually won the presidency. So, like, were they surprised by that? Like, what was the nature of the kind of calculation they were making there?
I think all that is right, that in the early going, they assumed he would lose, because almost everyone, especially where we live and these folks also live amongst liberals and leftists on the coast and a few other places, thought Trump would lose. I think from the beginning, these are folks at this moment who understand that they've let a genie out of the bottle over decades. Mm-hmm. They've run a very scary movement and run it, you know, by appealing to very dark forces in American history, both mm-hmm. racist and religious, and then didn't, you know, give them much love. And especially on the economic side. And I think they were right to sense that fusionism was now failing. It had succeeded so well that it couldn't last. And mm-hmm. It was a kind of sorcerer's apprentice moment, if you like, when Trump mm-hmm. represented their handiwork. And as soon as that happened, they felt the need to either try to keep controlling it or, you know, try to place a distance between themselves and what they'd produce. Now, when Trump won, some of them flirted with going back into the stance of like whispering in his ear. A famous case would be John Yoo, another neocon-ish figure who opposed Trump and then, you know, famously now ends up kind of being a kind of toady, if we can use that, you know, Barry Weiss term to describe John Yoo.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it seems like an understatement when it comes to John Yoo.
The very first thing I wrote about Trump in August of 2015 was called Riding the Trump Tiger. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that in that first Fox debate, remember the one where he accused Megyn Kelly of questioning him a certain way, basically because she was
on her period,
having her period.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know, they would trot out the disgusting things Trump has said, try to fact check him. And my thought was, why would Fox News listeners be concerned with like fact checking Trump or making sure that, you know, what he was saying was sober and based in reality? It just didn't, it just seemed to me like that was going to be a failed strategy. But I point that out to say that I agree with you that these people kind of, their involvement in the conservative movement and right-wing politics was one of kind of nursing some of these uglier impulses. And then when it kind of turned around and caught them, when they found themselves on the outs with that, you know, like you said, they just kind of lost control of it. And I'm wondering if they've reckoned with that at all. I know some have, like Max Boot, maybe. Maybe they haven't reckoned with it to the extent we might like. But what has been there, and it might vary, you know, different of these people will have reacted differently. But what's your sense of their understanding of where Trump came from and how he relates to Republican politics and conservative politics over the past few decades? Have they really grappled with that?
I'm not necessarily right about this, but I think not much or superficially. And then when they've done it as career strategy, you know, these are people who knew all along what they were doing. And again, this is my beef with kind of too noble an interpretation of their, you know, motives and stance, yeah. That to think that, you know, Max Boot just realized that he was helping steward a racist party so that he could get the places he wanted invaded, just doesn't, you know, is not credible. And I think that applies to all of the above. Now, you know, I cite Douthat, who says, look, you know, we turned a blind eye, you know, but the reason that could be done is because of the benefits that they were reaping in many cases, that they were getting the policies they wanted and really disrespecting their own, you know, constituencies in doing so, especially on economic policy, but also on endless war. And it's hard to, you know, it's not like they did that accidentally. Back a century ago, someone said the British conquered the world in a fit of the absence of mind, you know, which is ridiculous. Yeah. And I don't think it was just somehow they belatedly realized that they had, you know, sowed the wind. It, when they began, you know, with the rest of us reaping the whirlwind of Trump's election, I think it's true that there was some kind of recognition, but I think it was limited. Very few, especially on the economic side, began to think about how their policies had created Trump, or the military or foreign policy side. You know, someone like Max Boot and many of these people who advance their careers by becoming never Trumpers. I mean, one thing I do in the piece is describe all of the mainstream outlets who rush to hire these folks.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, they then, you know, were in a new crowd with a new audience, and they engaged in some ritualistic introspection, which I would not credit as very real, and in any case, very belated and inadequate.
Yeah, it really is. It's it's clearly a big part of their kind of in-group self-conception, what they do for each other, which is to sort of, you know, boost each other up and say, like, God, we really are the ones with principles. And I listened to, for my sins, the Bulwark podcast with Charlie Sykes quite a bit, mostly for this sort of psychological intrigue. But so much of it is just going, God, all these Republicans, they're so bad. And we are the only good ones. And it's just, there's so much kind of like mutual self-solving kind of commiseration that's going on. Like, just basically they're saving each other's egos through these like acts of self-aggrandizement. And it's so transparent. And then the fact that, you know, so much of that self-conception is built on the idea that they've sacrificed so much, right? Like that they had to give up their careers as, you know, prominent Republican consultants or campaign strategists or public intellectuals, and that now they have all these friends who won't talk to them, and they're on the outs in this world that they grew up in and that came into their careers in and that is so valuable to them, that they're the suffering Cassandras of the conservative movement. It's bullshit. But precisely because of what you're saying, they have a whole new audience of liberals and mainstream outlets and liberal opinion boards and millions of mainstream Democrats on Twitter who love Bill Kristol now. You know, they haven't really had to sacrifice anything in terms of that kind of raw ego boosting that propels probably a lot of their careers.
I'm obviously in general agreement. I guess I would say in more fairness, we have to think of a kind of chronological strategy, that there were short-term losses.
Yeah.
And, you know, they did give up influence over at least, you know, what politicians were saying publicly and in the Republican Party, because it's true that there was a big divergence between these folks and the institutional Republican Party, and especially kind of members of Congress who kowtowed to Trump. Yeah. or pretended to, because they were getting all of Republican policies back for decades, tax cuts and reactionary judges done. You know, maybe there was some love lost.
Yeah.
And not just kind of strategic distancing, although I think we need to do more research. But it's absolutely true that, you know, in very, you know, mercenary terms, a lot of the more journalistic types got huge, you know, upgrades in their careers. Maybe the national security types who were in think tanks like didn't get to go to the White House or chose not to, and that's a loss.
Yeah.
But again, it's part of a medium to long-term strategy. I think their big mistake was, as you say, they didn't realize, but then few did, that Trump would win. And they thought they were just waiting for, you know, Hillary Clinton's term to regroup and bring her down and get back into power immediately. As it turns out, the strategy is a longer term one than they initially realized.
Well, let's get to the next part of your thesis, which is you sort of coming up to date and after the election and what they've tried to do, how to position themselves and sort of regroup and gain power vis-a-vis not the Republicans but the Democrats.
Yeah, so, you know, basically I argue that we can't stop the clock in November 2016. It's important to think about that year when they're forming their movement. But their big roles, especially since Trump does win and these folks are out of power, is what new alliances they make, and just as important, how they're welcomed in an incredibly opportunistic way by centrists who understand after 2016 that they have their own party, the Democratic one, over which they might lose control and over which they nearly did in 2020. And so I've taken some pushback for this and fairly online, including from the authors of the book I reviewed in The New Republic, that maybe I overstate how big a role the Never Trump movement in particular played in ending Bernie Sanders' hopes to be the Democratic presidential nominee. But I think the bigger argument would be, from the beginning in mainstream media, MSNBC, New York Times, Washington Post, where these never Trumpers got canonized as patriots and heroes. This movement set the terms of respectable consensus, the conventional wisdom. They also were very deeply involved in, you know, the main kind of focus of American politics over the past 3 years, which were successfully Robert Mueller's investigation and the impeachment of the president, both of which I've written very skeptically about while they were happening, mm-hmm. and, you know, getting very exercised about how much Never Trumpers were helping set the terms of the mainstream Democrats and really of the conventional wisdom about what politically matters in the country under Trump.
I mean, so Sam, you're basically saying, or one of the things you're saying, and I think you quote Bill Kristol to this end in your review, which is that for them, Bernie Sanders was the left-wing analog of Trump.
Correct. They're completely open about it.
A kind of populist who falls outside this respectable consensus they've helped shape. And so, yeah, it's possible to overstate the effects of that, but, and it is hard to kind of quantify that climate of opinion. But I mean, I guess there's kind of two levels to it, right? One of them is simply saying that Bernie is a kind of analog to Trump. But I think maybe at a deeper level, it's like the issues they put in play. This might not be quite the right way to put it, but because obviously impeaching the president is political, but rather than focusing on the kind of substantive reasons Trump might have gained traction or focusing on a genuine kind of alternative agenda, what they want to do, you know, what should be done to counter Trump, it focused a lot on Trump's person, his personal failings, his personal grotesqueries. And that's I don't want to say apolitical, but it's by centering Trump the man, maybe that helped kind of shift the terms of debate away from terms that the left that would have been more favorable to the left. Does that make sense?
I would say not just Trump the man, but also, and drawing on some of your other works, Sam, his danger to liberal democracy as such.
Exactly. So those are really important points. So, I mean, maybe, you know, going backwards, you know, I think we have not yet come to an understanding of why Bernie lost. And, you know, we should leave open how big a role these folks played in that kind of narrow time frame and that narrow result. As I said, the main focus of this response that's been written by the authors I reviewed in the New Republic is just on that narrow topic, and they push back saying, no, the reasons are completely different. Never Trumpers had nothing or little to do with that outcome. Although, as you know, some of the principals themselves, you know, Bill Kristol and so forth, Jennifer Rubin, Charlie Sykes, Rick Wilson, have all cited my piece on Twitter and said, no, that's exactly right. We were trying to achieve centrist consolidation against the right and left. But you're completely right that even if I'm wrong about that narrow time frame and outcome, Bernie's loss, I think it's much more important to think broadly. So we go back to 2016 and say, what happened? Well, you had a revolt against both parties within each and against each, one more successful than the other. These people are Republicans who lost control of their party. That didn't happen entirely in the Democratic Party, not least since Hillary prevailed over Sanders in 2016. And, you know, I read those events as suggesting that it's just true that elites and elite policies like endless war and economic neoliberalism have been delegitimated out in the country, both as a liberal and as a conservative set of policies, because they actually were both enacted by both parties and the mainstreams of both parties. And that suggests that, you know, we have another option in the country, and we definitely need one if like me, you oppose both of these policies, endless war and economic neoliberalism. So to me, like, you know, the 2016 opens up this contest over, you know, what elites have done to the country over the endurance of these policies. And that ought to be the focus. And it just hasn't been, because we've been given distractions. And my view is that focusing on Trump has been, you know, partly honorable and reasonable in light of some of his horrific conduct, you know, leaving aside his character, but also a strategy of distraction from what's really ailing the country and the rightful condemnation of both political parties that 2016 involved.
Yeah, we've alluded to this, but it's worth saying that this piece is, in a way that I find almost unique of any sort of piece of writing that makes its way through the Twitterverse, has been embraced by every faction. So your piece, leftists agree because we agree with this thesis for the most part. What you're saying,
right?
That there's been an elite consolidation of center-right and center-left politicians now mostly operating within the Democratic Party to contain the left and prevent there from being a real conversation about the fundamental failure of elites in the past number of decades. Then you've got, like we've said, all the people who are the subject of the piece saying, yeah, that's what we did. Like, good on us. We did it. Jennifer Rubin replied to Bill Kristol's tweet of your article, saying, there's a lot to say for this. If the result is destruction of the GOP right-wing populist party and a successful center-left party, it would achieve what the, quote, inevitable, irretrievable polarization crowd thought impossible. She's saying, yeah, like, this is what we were trying to do, create a new alignment around centrist policies, you know, economic and foreign policy. But even on the more Trumpy right, I saw Will Chamberlain, the editor of Human Events, tweeted out and said, this piece on Never Trump is awesome and you should read it. So you've somehow managed to communicate a thesis that everyone can agree is correct, even though they fundamentally disagree about whether it's a good yeah. thing, the outcome that is being described in the piece.
Well, can I hop in on that point? Do you think the kind of centrist Democrats agree with that?
I think that it's an extraordinary phenomenon. I want to just mention in passing that I wrote this review 4 months ago, and it just wasn't published until a couple of days ago, and in part because of when I wrote it. That's one of the reasons I may be focused over much on the narrow Sanders outcome and less on the kind of predicate for that, which is the larger kind of making of the centrist conventional wisdom. Of course, the authors of the book I reviewed most emphatically don't agree with the piece.
Yeah.
So that's why it's amazing that, you know, everyone else does for very different reasons. I think they would say, and there's something to this, that the Never Trumpers are agreeing with the piece because that awards them a huge amount of credit and power for results that, you know, maybe they intended, but maybe, you know, there's a bit of overclaiming about how much they're actually responsible for it. But I think you would get some anxiety from Democrats themselves, who the very ones who have made alliances with Never Trumpers, because they probably would not say openly that they were engaged in a political strategy just like the Never Trumpers, although they said to protect liberal democracy from despotism, really to defend their own institutional and ideological power against their own left. And they don't want, you know, to look, you know, to Americans as if they prefer alliances with Republicans, fundamentally ex-Republicans or, you know, the true Republicans, in order to maintain their own power in their party. Now, you know, if we go back, there's the neocons have now switched parties twice, because they emerged in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, Scoop Jackson Democrats.
Scoop Jackson Democrats. Wherever they can gain power, they'll do it. And there is a worry, depending on what Joe Biden's policy is like, that's kind of what's going to happen. I'm not totally sure, but I think the more interesting thing of all this agreement with the piece is to say, you know, it casts a light on our situation, which is that
there is
a possibility of realignment where we put all the militarists and neoliberals in one party. And the centrists who, you know, are never Trumpers and liberal resistance figures do fit together in that way. Mm-hmm. The tough thing for the left is that we do share some things with the right, which, you know, they succeeded in winning over their party. We did not yet. And they have some overlap in views, both on the foreign policy side and the economic side. And we haven't figured out how to broker a class majority party.
Yeah, we'll have to take up the question of right-left strategic alignments around neoliberalism and endless war, but maybe in a minute. Matt, did you have something to say?
Yeah, it occurred to me that this kind of alliance between more centrist Democrats, or, you know, you put it between neoliberals and warmongers, is interesting to me, because after the 2018 midterms, this was kind of my worry, right? When you saw places where Democrats were doing well, winning in kind of white suburbs, it seemed to me
with
that
former CIA agents.
Yes. And of course, there were a lot of women who won. I don't want to downplay any of that. But it seemed to me like, as a demographic base, what Never Trumpers are peddling would appeal to them, right? Because it's not especially ideological. And again, it's focused on Trump's threat to democracy. And so for a couple of years, I've been worried that this would be the kind of the way things went.
Undoubtedly, that's happening. I mean, that, you know, like the people going gaga over Project Lincoln, it's, yes. You know, obviously there's some people in the South who still hate Lincoln, but, you know, Lincoln is kind of like the American totem. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a kind of post-partisan, post-ideological project.
Yes.
But actually, we need more ideology and not less, more contest, less compromise. And, you know, these are folks who just wish Trump would go away. And
yes.
I think that he will. The trouble is what happens after that, when these centrists think they just go back to the status quo anti-Trump, except that status quo caused Trump, including the very policies of the Never Trumpers.
Yeah.
Preparing for this episode, I was looking at the Lincoln Project website and some of the videos they put out. And one of their latest ones was Trump sitting down with Chris Wallace, that kind of absurd interview he gave recently. And it was set to like a Seinfeld laugh track and like the Seinfeld music. And it was just kind of Trump being foolish, kind of cut to make him look as, I mean, it didn't take much cutting to make him look bad, but, you know, pulling out the worst and most ridiculous aspects of what he said, setting it to this kind of in this Seinfeld framework with the music and the laugh track. And it does strike me as very not political in one sense, not ideological. And, you know, I'm of two minds about that, maybe to offer some pushback. What would you say to if someone wanted to defend the Lincoln Project or some of the what Never Trumpers are doing, who say, well, Trump really is terrible. We really should vote him out of office. And if these video ads, you know, move some suburban housewife to think, you know, Trump really is ridiculous, I'm just going to vote for Biden. Is that bad?
I think it's a fair question. You know, so a couple of points. You know, the broader point would have to be that it really is a kind of Seinfeld project. It harkens back to the 1990s.
It's about nothing.
End of history. Really nothing else. Yeah, joking about nothing because everything's settled.
Such a good point.
It's just, you know, we just laugh at the atavistic challengers to, you know, American hegemony and neoliberal mm-hmm. internationalism. And it's deeply nostalgic in that way, except that, you know, they have not accounted for what went wrong, mm-hmm. except in the most unpersuasive ways, you know, blaming democracy for, you know, or populism, quote unquote, for, you know, the unwashed vote their emotions and, mm-hmm. you know, indulge their fears and don't realize what's best for them. And I just think it's so evasive. It reflects a failure to reckon with what they've wrought. But you know, absolutely. Now I should face your fair note of skepticism, because it may be that it's harmless. certainly less harmful than I implied. And maybe if we kind of select out just the Lincoln project and kind of, you know, isolate it from these earlier events like, you know, the Mueller mania and the impeachment frenzy, you know, we say it's an unqualified good to, you know, especially to get these ad men, like, you know, I think that's what Rick Wilson actually knows how to do, and let them bring down the president. So I guess my only concern is that these are folks who are building enormous brands, selling, you know, lots of books. There's no compromise that's costless. And so what we really have to do is debate what are the costs. And we don't know yet, because we don't know how much these people are going to continue to get honored once Trump falls. You know, I think what we're going to see, I'm very worried about it, is a canonization of the resistance, left and right. And they're going to be, you know, the Lincolnians who save the country from, you know, civil war. They're going to be the anti-fascists who saved us from fascism. And it'll just be a huge distraction from the restoration of these baleful policies in which all of these people really believe. And we're not really arguing about those policies. They're not defending them. They'll get a policy space to reinstitute them, and they'll get their careers advanced to be eligible for appointment, for continuing to opine. I mean, what is Jennifer Rubin's game at the Washington Post going to be after Trump falls? Well, it'll have to be very different, but she's still got the job.
Yeah. No, I thought of that too. Like, what will David Frum write about at The Atlantic now? You know, sometimes it's almost amusing when you pull up the author pages of a Jennifer Rubin or a David Frum, and you look at just the headlines of their articles. It's like, how can they keep getting paid to just churn out the same shit over and over and over?
Like, this time Trump went too far, over and over and over again?
Well, yeah, just kind of constantly commenting on his psychological defects for holding high office.
Well, there's an audience. I mean, there's an audience, and that's even scarier. And, you know, the audience is disproportionately influential and wealthy.
Powerful, yeah.
And they understand that these folks are telling them what they want to hear. And that's why it's very, you know, disturbing that they will have a huge audience. The Atlantic, you know, the New York Times having hired several of these people and only very glancingly leftists, the Washington Post even more. I think it doesn't bode well for the making of like the conventional wisdom after Biden wins.
I did start reading the Soudan and Tellis book, and it begins with the foreign policy establishment, right? And I was struck reading it, the kind of tone was, you know, there's this bipartisan or cross-partisan foreign policy establishment. You know, it talked about, you know, you might have Brookings on one side and the Center for Strategic and International Studies leans a little more right, you know, so there are kind of Democrat and Republican shops, but there's a lot of fellow feeling among the people in the foreign policy establishment and elite, and how they viewed their time, the people who comprise this, the people who worked for, say, the George W. Bush administration, they view their government service as a high watermark of their careers. And it kind of had this self-pitying tone. And it seemed to me to totally miss the point that establishment had been responsible for untold wreckage, millions of lives lost, total catastrophe in so many ways. Well, the description of these poor people who were now not going to work in the government because Trump won the Republican nomination and the presidency, it was just, I couldn't believe it.
You know, I think it's true that these political scientists are right, that we need to study the cadres of movements and, you know, disaggregate them. And that's very useful. But I think that they make a huge mistake, first off, methodologically, and just asking these people why they hated Trump, which allows them just to vent rationalization. You know, there's a famous moment when, you know, Maureen Dowd responds to Judith Miller, who famously said that, you know, Ahmed Al-Chalabi told her that, you know, there were WMD and Dowd responds, but journalism is not stenography. And, you know, my critique of these political scientists is that they're too close and they just write down the rationalizations of mm-hmm. these people. If we scratch not even that far below the surface, we find people who are Trump washing, who are not owning their own contribution to the disaster, notably their advocacy of the Iraq war, their service of in the war on terror, and lots of other you know, outrageous American foreign policy traditions, like toting currying favor with dictators in Saudi Arabia and so forth. Uh-huh. And when they turn on a dime because Trump has the temerity to attack the Iraq war, which Republicans had not done in all of that time, they sense blood in the water. And I think that's the real reason that these people bolted. They couldn't have their own rectitude challenged, but that's just hypocrisy if we can't own our own mistakes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's maybe a different way of phrasing what I said was the description of this cross-partisan consensus that kind of holds sway in both parties. Maybe it's not as strong as it was during the Cold War, but nevertheless, it's like they didn't see that was could actually be considered incredibly damning. That a whole swath of
right.
of foreign policy professionals, they describe people, you know, getting a master's degree at Johns Hopkins and then, you know, maybe working for a Senate staff and then working for a campaign and then, you know, staffing the foreign policy dimensions of a administration, that's the point. That's what Trump was attacking.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to say too that to agree with you, I do think one of the most important moments of the campaign, the 2016 primary campaign for Trump, was that debate in South Carolina when he said Bush was president on 9/11 and he didn't keep us safe and that the Iraq war was a disaster.
Yep.
And you could kind of see people lose their minds in real time. It was shocking to see, but
that's true.
It's just unbelievable that they can't see why that might have resonated with ordinary people. And in South Carolina, a military state, Trump won.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing if we go back in real time to that. Of course, initially the response is that they think Trump has doomed himself. Uh-huh. They're so confused that they don't know where the country is. And it goes back to our earlier discussion about, you know, leaders of a movement losing control of where the shock troops, the voters on whom you've relied to just follow you blindly, are. And it also has to do with economics and trade policy, where, you know, just the very, you know, when Trump says, neoliberalism has not been good for the American middle class, and especially the working class. It's really something that was not, you know, something you could not utter in mm-hmm. Republican circles. So you and of course, both on the foreign policy side and the economic side, you're right that this is the blob and the Washington consensus, which came by its name honestly, which, you know, pervaded both parties and the mainstream of both parties. And, you know, I think we should take Trump as a referendum on the Democrats, not just the Republicans, mm-hmm. and figure out how do we, you know, take seriously the charges he made, which were apt. His remedies were obviously outrageous, and actually, you know, he didn't even try to follow through on some of them. And to the extent he did, they were, you know, right-wing nationalist solutions. Mm-hmm. I think it's like a moment of opportunity that we haven't had in my lifetime, and I'm older than you guys. Mm-hmm. To kind of revisit all of these priors. And Never Trump is about avoiding that reckoning.
Mm-hmm. Because Matt mentioned Johns Hopkins. There was one person who did not like your piece.
I knew this was coming.
Yasha Munk did not like your piece.
No, that's true.
He screenshotted. He did not want to give it any extra traffic. So he screenshotted a few portions of it and said some things. We could get into what he actually said, though it wasn't very substantive. you know, he basically suggested that you are someone who thought of yourself as very smart and highly erudite. But I find it interesting, and you know that I have a little bit of a fixation on him, but I think that he is kind of, though he's not a never-Trumper, he wasn't he is against Trump very much so and has allied himself with a lot of these people. He wasn't a Republican beforehand, but he does represent really clearly, Monk, the evacuation of policy substance, especially as it relates to like economic distribution, from a discussion of like liberal norms as such. Like the whole focus of his project is to evacuate any kind of question of social rights and the distribution of power, of economic power, so that we only focus on authoritarianism as such, the defense of democratic norms, and like a kind of like fantasy of an ideal functioning liberal democracy. And his career also, I mean, I was reminded of this because I reread Panjak Mishra's dual review of your book and Monk's book in the LRB. His career really represents the process of sort of abandoning, in his case, sort of like youthful criticism of people like Tony Blair for being in some ways responsible for creating the conditions for the rise of right populism, and then instead going to work for Tony Blair and basically participate very actively in this centrist restoration project, which is very good for his career, but is ideologically and intellectually vapid.
You know, his response was remarkable on a number of levels. First, let's note that he screen capped a thread that I did, which kind of added some detail about the kind of fascism debate we've been having and how we should think about the way the never Trumpers relate to it. You know, really just ridiculed the position I tried to lay out there. And as you said, you know, kind of humorously treated me as this egghead, you know, who was thinking too hard.
Yeah. Well, Yasha could never be accused of thinking too hard.
Well, I think he's a bright guy, but I just think it's incredibly hypocritical to set yourself up as a steward of persuasion in the country and reasonable discourse, and then to dunk on people non-substantively and, you know, not kind of take seriously the argument, especially when, you know, all I was kind of reminding people about is that there's a standard account of the rise of fascism in European history that says that centrists are a big part of it historically.
Yeah.
And, you know, not to acknowledge what like the consensus of historians is in this moment, I think is a real missed opportunity for those in the center who do want to preserve liberal democracy, or at least say that's what they care about, rather than, you know, their brand and, you know, their you know, book royalties.
Right.
Well, could you say what that consensus is? I'm not sure if we've actually laid that out, but for listeners, what is this kind of consensus about Weimar Germany and the rise of fascism and how left, right, center factor into it?
Yeah. So, obviously, fascism arises as an extremist movement in European history. But when it arises, it has to build a constituency. And the kind of standard account, which I connected with a Harvard historian named Charles Mayer in the thread, but you can also connect it with an old colleague of mine at Columbia University named Robert Paxton, is that the really decisive moment is when let's call it the bourgeois center in class terms, decides that its class interests can't survive the rise of the left, and that radical solutions need to be chosen in order to maintain their class privilege. And So there's a big scholarship about this, and we can debate the details in the different countries. But, you know, fundamentally, the fascism happens in at least many places, the places I know about in early 20th century Europe, when the ideological center turns to the right to protect its class hegemony. And we'd have to kind of get complex on this because, of course, you know, Adolf Hitler founded a National Socialist Party, and there is a kind of like leftist faint in many fascist politicians. Benito Mussolini began his career as an anarcho-syndicalist and so forth. But I mean, the standard history says that, you know, you have the center right politics, which can be compatible with democracy, but can also kind of be a path to fascism.
Right. And this is where we get to a real tricky nugget of your work and your kind of commentary in this period, I think, because there really is good reason to be concerned about, maybe not in the histrionic way in which some people are, but there is good reason to be concerned about the status of liberal democracy as such, liberal democratic norms in America, but even more so in other European countries. You know, I mean, and even here, even now, I mean, we're talking about fascism because we see forces at work in American politics on the right that seem quite comfortable, both people in on the fringe and also people who are sort of more intellectuals in good standing, who seem to be losing interest in democracy, in liberalism, in sort of, you know, we've talked about them on the podcast a lot, post-liberals, people who basically have decided that we need to maintain control of the sort of morals of this country via minoritarian rule. And so there's good reason to be concerned about that stuff as such. But what you have cautioned against is focusing on the threat to democracy, the totalitarian danger, tyrannophobia, over and above talking about the conditions that have created that danger. But the problem is that sometimes when you say, when one sort of says, well, don't focus on those norms, we need to focus on the conditions that created the hostility to those norms, people say, well, those norms are actually really important. Why are you telling us not to be worried about it? It's like a very
right
tough dance, and I'd be interested if you want to unpack that.
No, I mean, it's a huge topic, and I've become notorious in some quarters for trying to outline a kind of cautious stance in this moment. There are many things to say, but maybe just briefly I'll start with the fact that there are folks who are you know, intellectuals and others who have turned their back on liberal democracy. And I think we should just remember that the baseline is that they never really believed in it to begin with. Attitude towards liberal democracy in America is sort of Mohandas Gandhi's when asked about Western civilization, that it would be a nice idea to have a liberal country and to have a democracy. And we should never forget, of course, that Donald Trump won because of the anti-democratic features of the American regime. But I developed this view kind of out of two reasons in the early going. One was just that I thought that it was wrong to analogize, January 20th, 2017 to January 1933, which many people were doing. And it's just because it didn't give us a sense of what Donald Trump would do and how he would exercise the extraordinary power that, again, the mainstream left and right is given the presidency. Several years later, my view is, to indict all the horror, at the border in Portland, but also to note that the dynamic is really falsifying not just those early, fears, but even the general idea that the problem is an erosion of liberal democracy as a regime form. Every time Donald Trump acts, he's checked, including, in fairness, by anti-fascist mobilization, but also lots of other institutions and forces. You know, he does something terrible in Portland and then reverses policy. You know, to go back several years, the travel ban is laundered, including by the Supreme Court, through a system that makes it legal, albeit broader. And so my sense is that we have to understand, as of today, Donald Trump as the weakest American president in our lifetimes, one who is constrained in his actions by his own staff, has a lot of power on paper because we've given it to the presidency over generations, but has been unable to exercise it. Now, we can have a debate about whether we should call his personality or some of his acts fascist or despotic or totalitarian, but the outcome seems to me to be one in which it turns out that this kind of mainstream is very powerful. And the voters are the ones who seem weak. They can't shake the hegemony of these mainstreams no matter what they do. And that is an incredibly troubling thing. And I think more troubling than anything Donald Trump has done.
I wanted to ask you something about that, or related to that, that's in your Tyrannophobia piece of, we'll include this in the show notes, but it was published in 2017. But there was a line in there I thought it might be worth you unpacking, which is, it comes right near the end, and you say, if there is one lesson from the 20th century worth learning, it is that an exclusive focus on the defense of liberal fundamentals against a supposed totalitarian peril often exacerbates the social and international conflicts it seeks to resolve. What did you mean by that? I mean, we've kind of circled around it, but that was such an apt way of putting it and such a succinct way of putting it. I thought you might explain what that kind of mechanism was.
Well, so, you know, this is actually, it's very apropos, so thanks, that, you know, maybe the best way to understand our moment and really the Never Trump movement is as an attempt to revive specifically Cold War liberalism, mm-hmm. which was, again, a centrist left-right project, the Vital Center, about, yes, opposing, you know, versions of American nativism and fascism, but also about containing the left. And very explicitly, the Cold War liberalism is about the ever-present threat of tyranny, and the need for the state and society be organized in such a way that first and foremost freedom is protected, which really means contract and property. Now, the funny thing about Cold War liberalism, which was a transatlantic project, it's what my next book is about, actually, is that it was endorsed by a lot of social democrats in the Cold War who don't ever get around to defending theoretically the emergence of the welfare state through which they're living. You know, someone like Arthur Schlesinger is way to the left of anyone who's a Never Trumper or resistance member in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
For that matter, Richard Nixon was too, but let's not go there. Yeah. And I guess my trouble is that Cold War liberalism eventually kind of sows the seed for the undoing of, you know, a welfare orthodoxy in the middle of the 20th century. Or help sow the seeds by stigmatizing the state and saying freedom matters most, equality is dangerous, the state is proto-tyrannical. And what you get after 2016 is like the massive renovation and revival of these views, which basically say, you know, if we're on the brink of tyranny, what we need to do is protect freedom against the state. And of course, that's the core view of neoliberalism. And it's also a core view of a crusading neoconservatism, which is about kind of, you know, setting up capitalism worldwide, you know, in the name of democracy promotion.
Yeah.
Well, could you just say more about the construction of an idea like totalitarianism, like how it functions? You've indicated that some already, but
sure.
I've been reading like James Chappelle's Catholic Modern.
Oh, okay, great.
Which has opened my eyes in certain ways to kind of how terms like totalitarian function. Because it seems at one level, like, sure, the Soviet Union was totalitarian. You can look at the gulags, you can, you know, point to all their atrocities and crimes. But like to give it a name and a concept like that against which you define liberal democracy, that's something I'm kind of reading and learning more about.
So James shows that initially totalitarianism theory, which is really minted by Roman Catholic intellectuals in the 1930s, mm-hmm. is not liberal. When these folks are doing their work, they think there's going to be an alternative to liberalism that's also an alternative both to secular paganism, fascism, and, you know, this other form of secular materialism, communism or totalitarianism in mm-hmm. the Soviet Union. And they're the first ones to say we need a general concept to be able to compare and consolidate fascism and communism. Liberals don't do that first, not least since they need the communists in World War II who, you know, win the war for the West, you know, certainly in the European theater. Once the Cold War develops, I mean, there's been a dry run of the Cold War amongst Catholics and others in the interwar period. Liberals kind of appropriate the idea of totalitarianism, and they say we're the centrists. There's no such thing as an illiberal, you know, defense of the center now. Rather, we'll defend, you know, human rights, and we'll defend some version of democracy, a kind of minimalist form in which people vote every few years, and then submit to, you know, their rulers. They hate populism. They hate mass mobilization, which they, you know, denounce as totalitarian too. And so there's this very, let's say, disturbing story about how even though these people, as I've said, are defenders of like the biggest liberal state in history and a redistributive state and an egalitarian state, they adopt this old right-wing construction, because it serves them to say we beat the fascists, we've quarantined them in America, they're no longer welcome in polite conversation, and now we just need to make sure that the left is hemmed in. Of course, we hate Joe McCarthy. We can't have that kind of paranoia. That's very scary, Richard Hofstadter and so forth. But what we're trying to do is consolidate a center that, you know, keeps mass mobilization at bay and keeps demagogy at bay, not just on the right, but on the left. And, you know, it doesn't work out well because, of course, that synthesis doesn't last. It gives way to first the Cold War militarism, which we're still living with in a certain ways, but above all, the neoliberal turn of the 1970s and since, which I think would have horrified the very Cold War liberals who thought they were signing up to defend the welfare state and just failed to do so.
To kind of draw out the parallel, like the speaking of Yascha Mounk, the kind of discourse about populism.
Absolutely.
Does that kind of map onto that? You said a fear of mass mobilization was the line you used, the phrase you used.
Absolutely.
And it seems like that's kind of what's lurking beneath this fear of populism that's exhibited by people who self-style themselves as defenders of liberal democracy.
Correct. It's just a word that functions the way totalitarianism does to conflate different things, or to say that populism is the same left and right. And, you know, Yasha, you know, all credit to him, is a great revivalist of Cold War liberalism. And that's why the alliance of Never Trump with centrist resistance figures like Monk makes a lot of sense, because it's really a return to the old bipartisan consensus of the Cold War around like freedom rather than, you know, democracy or social justice.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because this is always where we end up in our podcasts, and because because Matt and I are both interested in your thoughts about it, we probably should talk about the right-wing critics of endless war and neoliberal economic policies, with whom certain people on the left are trying to figure out if there's any alliance to be made, and how the post-liberals on the right kind of fit into this story.
Let's just disaggregate, because I think it's not the same to talk about foreign policy and economic policy. There's more clearly a pathway to a foreign policy consensus of restraint, and that's why you get things like the Quincy Institute, of which I'm a part, that's headed by Andrew Bacevich. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the content in American Conservative Magazine is just, you know, calling for restraint, very critical of humanitarian intervention, more critical of regime change, and of the global military footprint that America has kind of adopted since World War II. And there it seems like there's a productive alliance, and it's already happening. And of course, there are big fights to have, but it's plausible. Now, I think that what we've seen is the rise of post-liberals who really can't be part of these projects. If we take, you know, many of these folks, they really don't have much to say about foreign policy in particular. They do attack neoconservatives, but foreign policy is not their focus, if we're talking about Patrick Deneen or Adrian Vermeul or others. When we get into economics, I think it's murkier, because the post-liberals do focus much more there. But if we take someone whom I've taught with as a friend, happens to live across the street, your former guest Ross Douthat, whom I refer to in my piece in the New Republic as a soft Never Trumper. He's also a soft post-liberal. And it's really on grounds that he sees a future for conservatism that's a class-based future. And I think that's very different than, you know, what the true post-liberals are calling for. I don't think leftists can ever ally with the post-liberals of that sort. But there is room for, if there's going to be a return to a working class politics, for alliance with, let's say, the softer anti-liberals, because they've husbanded their own critique of neoliberalism. And as we've talked about on this podcast, the shock troops of the Republican Party, the fusionist project, have been betrayed by the libertarian leadership of that project, and they're there for a working class movement to attract. You know, the critical thing is, will it be a left wing movement in the end, a progressive one that's transracial? And you know, there are going to be compromises potentially to be made there, but also lines to be drawn, even with regard to some of the soft kind of post liberals, because, you know, the terms of the compromise are everything. And I think they're going to be harder when it comes to economics than when it comes to like restraint, which is very, very easy to agree about, not invading somewhere. And you don't have to agree about a lot of other things.
Yeah, you don't have to craft a complicated policy or
exactly
distributive mechanism or anything.
That's right. And, you know, the left can't just be for restraint. So, you know, the left will rightly, you know, bridle, even to the extent they enter consensus over foreign policy with some on the right. They also will need to be internationalists in the end, and will need to have a plausible foreign policy internationalism, which a lot of these, you know, potential allies just don't want in any form.
Yeah.
Well, this is, well, Sam, when you said earlier that there was a kind of way in which voters, the people can't kind of shake this hegemony of, you know, the center left and center right. There can't be a breakthrough. There hasn't been one yet. This is why I kind of despair, because it's you can't imagine kind of coalitions and compromise when it comes to restraint and foreign policy. And there might even be alliances to be made on specific economic policy, right? Like you can imagine a certain piece of legislation that both Bernie Sanders would vote for and maybe some of the more populist Republicans would vote for too. I don't have anything specific in mind, but it's imaginable for like very specific alliances on specific pieces of legislation to happen. But it's hard to imagine a political party, which is, you know, what you would need to really seize power, that included both I don't know, Ilhan Omar and Josh Hawley, right?
No, I mean, it can include Hawley, you know, but it can include some of Hawley's voters.
Right. So I was kind of wondering how you saw, this is another way of getting at what we've been talking about, but how, if there is a breakthrough, what would that look like for you? Because of the skittishness about a kind of more formal alliance with some of these more populist figures on the right, but can their voters, can the people who might be attracted to them as voters be won over?
I think so. I mean, I'm ever an optimist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my beef in all of the different aspects that we've been talking about is that that's the crucial hard work that really got postponed in the age of Trump through mm-hmm. the nefarious success of the Never Trumpers in reorienting our gaze and this centrist, you know, melodrama around the resistance. And so, no, I don't have all the answers, but I am, you know, heartened first by the fact that the kinds of politicians we support can break through outside some of the usual places. And where I'm from, St. Louis, Missouri, in my old district, Cori Bush won the other day. Now, no, she's not going to appeal to Missouri generally, which has become a red state in my lifetime. But the fundamentals are there for a working class politics. What it would require is first some negative work, putting all the neoliberals together. And so maybe this period we've lived through is useful because they are together very openly. It's just that they're together as of today in our party, the Progressive Party. And then there's the positive work, because, you know, not to go with Mark Lilla, who I've criticized very, you know, vitriolically in Boston Review, but you know, it's the case that it's very difficult as of today to figure out the terms of a working class party that's transracial. I think it has to be done because the Democrats have failed no one more than African Americans in my lifetime. And I think that helps explain 2016 too, you know, falling turnout in urban settings in the swing states were the main cause of Donald Trump's victory in those states, because his coalition, you know, was not principally working class. It included some, but was multifaceted. But the fact that the Democrats have failed so badly its own working class constituency, African Americans first and foremost, I think is just a crying shame, but it's also an opportunity for us to begin figuring out how to create a working class politics. And do cultural issues, quote unquote, identity politics, make that more difficult? Well, yes and no. You know, the fact is that in America, class politics is by definition a race politics. But as of today, and really on principle, the white workers matter. As a matter of justice, progressives should want a politics that attracts them and includes them. So how to create such a politics, we haven't gotten far enough. And the sad thing is we risked ceding that politics to the right in many places, like my home state of Missouri, where Josh Hawley is a senator.
You know, there are those on the left who are even more enthusiastic about at least putting out a message that is a class first, working class message, which avoids the traps, some of the traps of cultural issues or identity politics. I tend to think that that's a little naive, but I also think that even that project is undermined by the fact that the figures on the right who represent the convergence on economic policy are always insisting on bringing it back to culture.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Matt and I are reading Christopher Lash and Michael Lind for an episode on kind of culture war, class war. And that's the thesis, is like the class war is now a culture mm-hmm. war. So anytime you try to do what sort of maybe the class reductionists on the left right. would like to do, you can't do it anyway, because the discourse is going to be polluted by people like Josh Hawley, who will say, no, these people aren't on your side because they actually want you to like change your manners when you're around black people. And that's the main thing mm-hmm. that they want you to do. You know, they're always going to make the class war into a culture war.
Yeah.
And it's not that I don't think there's anything to be said for the ways that culture are mobilized by elites in order to maintain a certain class hierarchy, in the most sympathetic reading of what Lash says, for example. But we're always undermined by that, I think.
Well, I mean, we saw this during the pandemic, right? Where like the working class, as portrayed by someone like Patrick Deneen or Rusty Reno, is defined by, well, you know, they don't work out and go to the gym and you know, try to remain beautiful as long as possible. They don't fear death. They're willing to go back into the meat grinder. They just want to work. You know, they're not obsessed with self-preservation like you know, urban elites. And so the working class becomes not people with certain material interests, but people who have certain cultural preferences or kind of live a certain way, have certain values.
You know, no one solved this. I guess in its most abstract form, there's nothing new about this dilemma, in the sense that, you know, anti-Semitism was famously called the socialism of fools. And, you know, what we're dealing with on the right is the socialism of fools in all of its newer forms, including the, you know, border politics of fools and so forth. And, you know, it's not like we can just hope they stop. We have to answer them. I think that there's a lot of strategy on the left that has been extremely short-sighted over the past few decades. It's basically consisted of this self-interested abandonment of regions of the country, because then you can, you know, push through neoliberal policies in the Democratic Party that serve elite interests. And getting the resistance in a way out of the Democratic Party is incredibly important, because it would allow Democrats to be the working class party that they have not consistently been. And it would also allow them to try to broaden their appeal through policy changes, clear policy changes, to parts of the countries they've simply left behind. And will that mean they need to, you know, combine a class focus with, you know, a kind of cultural appeal? Probably, but it can't be at the price of the abandonment of the black working class and Latino working class, because they're disproportionately numerous in the working class. So, like, we can't even begin on that project, which is intricate, until we figure out how to shift the focus and, you know, ideally how to begin a realignment process, either within the Democratic Party or in some new party.
Mm-hmm. Matt wants to start the depressive, fragile left party.
Right.
I mean, I say that facetiously, but one of the things that we've talked about is how some of the ideas about that are sort of spiritually informed that we get into on this podcast do tend to attract like religious leftists or people who are in the process of moving from right to left, that there are ways of talking about like obligations to each other that have left wing implications, but that can be sort of in communication with faith traditions and other kinds of concepts of community that are more conservative in temperament and maybe in even genealogy.
Agreed. I mean, we can't give up, you know, community duties and obligations, religion, you know, even, you know, a nation in a kind of internationalist framework, which is, I mean, you know, a lot of thorny stuff there to not talk about now.
But
just ceding it all to Josh Hawley seems to me a monumental mistake. Unless we really do want to have a secessionist politics and end up with a couple of different countries. You know, I was at Harvard cocktail party in the immediate aftermath of Trump's election. And, you know, my then fellow Harvard professors, you know, I thought disgustingly just said their remedy was to, you know, secede.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a Missourian, that's an unacceptable option.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, Missourians are people too, and they're the ones who are also victims alongside, you know, some others. So not having a national and global politics that is, you know, sensitive to the range of victimhood, especially class victimhood, is not what the left has been about or should ever be about.
Mm-hmm. Well, should we wrap it up?
I think so. Yeah, thank you so much, Sam. This was really interesting and really helpful.
Thank you. I listened to every episode, so I won't listen to this one, but it's a privilege to be on it.
We were saying before we were recording how there are certain people who, if we found out that they really disliked the podcast, we would probably just stop. And you're in that category. So
great.
We're glad that you like it.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Sam.
No, thanks for doing it.
Thanks.
Sunlight.